Beneath me vibrated as if the men on the other side were bouncing up and down like unruly children in bed. But they were not. I listened, and their voices were steady. I still could not understand them. I pulled my head away and shook it, then repositioned myself and tried again. But they were speaking another language, nattering on in words that were mere syllables hurled and punched, and it was nonsense, all of it. Once I heard my name, twice I heard my name, and then a laugh. I looked back toward my specimen, my lady. My laboratory had grown dark. A storm had coagulated overhead, or it must have been the case, because the clouds were shimmering gray out through the window. Or, no, I couldn't see the sky from there. It must have been a sheet of water cascading where the gutters have rotted through, making the world outside look so much like a filthy aquarium. The gaslight flickered and went out, except that I hadn't turned it on, had I? It was definitely off, and the office was definitely gloomy, so gloomy that I could hardly see her, sitting in the jar, cradled there, but deserving better. She glimmered, and what little light remained in the room winked against the glass, showing off her sinuous swimming shape, twisting in the jar, a very slow whirlpool or a carousel, or the ethereal winding of a cotton candy machine. She pivoted to show me her whole self. She unfurled, and I was transfixed. I couldn't hear the men outside the door anymore. I don't know who Greer was talking to. Hansen, maybe, or Applegate. If they were still present, they'd gone silent. If they were standing on the other side of the door, they said nothing. I said nothing. I watched Physalia Zelikophorus. I looked away. I opened the door with my left hand. My right hand was holding something, and I could feel it, hard and cold, but I did not look down to see what it was. I did not care. I knew what to do, and I knew where to go. Into the hall I stepped. I walked, I proceeded. Down the hall, which was empty. No one whispered, and no chancellor hung about, spreading lies and gossip. No students walked past, shirking their responsibilities in favor of cigarettes behind the boiler room. This hallway was the quickest shortcut. They came and went like the tide, always leaving a trail of tobacco vapors in their wake. Like they accused me of leaving. What was it? The odor of the specimen in my wake. Like my office, the corridor was darkened, though it was midday, I was relatively confident. Midday, and not an ounce of sun to shine through at the ends of the hall, where a trio of great windows reached from almost floor to almost ceiling. They looked like the window in my office, now in my laboratory where the students come and go, covered in water that drained down the glass in cascades. The whole building was submerged, as it ought to be, to make her more comfortable. She was behind me on the table, in the jar. I wished for her, but there was nothing to be done, not now, not yet. Work to do first, then devotion. There was no one in the hall with me, and I walked it forever. My hand snatched out the one holding the blade. It was a blade, not a scalpel, something larger. Smaller than a machete, larger than a pocket knife. Large enough, at any rate. I lashed and struck like a snake at nothing, at no one, but there was blood on my hand when I looked down, and it wasn't mine. None of this was mine. But I was alone. Somehow this didn't confuse me. Somehow she urged me on and said that the answers would come. And she always speaks the truth and never lies to me. It isn't her way. I proceeded to Greer's office because he was there. I knew he was there. She told me he would be. I did not knock on the door because I do not knock on doors, not anymore. I certainly do not ask permission of worms like that man with his name upon the brass plate, his letters etched into the metal, scratched there by some printer's claw. I opened the door, and the knob was chilly in my hand, so chilly that my skin stuck to it. The blood or the water on my skin, it froze, and I pulled myself free with a twist after the twist of the knob. I did not like the metal, wasn't sure what it was, looked down and saw it was the old-fashioned iron sort, a lever, not a knob. I don't understand, because I thought I twisted it. But it was cold, very cold, and it was lying on the floor where I broke it off and dropped it, and the skin on my hand was torn, but it mended itself before my eyes. Dr. Greer shouted at me. Some querulous complaint. Zollicoffer! What's happened? What have you done? Some series of meaningless question marks cast at me like a spell. I understood his words again, and I understood that he was upset. He damned well ought to be upset. He defended her with his treatment of me. He defended us both. Her in the glass throne I would carry with me always. Me in the flesh and blood, covered in flesh and blood, holding a blade, the kind scientists use to saw through bone. It came from the biology lab. Did it? I couldn't recall having seen one like it there before. A fine steel thing, gleaming except where the gore had smudged off the shine, its edges ragged and grasping, its teeth chewing on bits of skin and gristle that had snagged upon them. I held it by the wooden handle. I held it with the blade point down the way she told me. I held his neck. He stopped yelling at me, and that was a terrible relief. I couldn't stand the sound of his voice anymore. I couldn't bear the volume of it, the weight and the frequency of it, not until it faded into gurgles and bubbles, and his desk was awash with crimson. The crimson was not as pretty as the water pouring down the windows outside. She warned me not to watch the water too long. She warned me to move on to the next office while there was time, before anyone intervened. I was unstoppable. But I mustn't stop. Greer's office door banged open, and Dr. Madison stood there, his mouth hanging open like a wound. He began to shout, and his shouting was even worse than Greer's, which was truly saying something. His shouting took longer to stop. I had to drag him inside. He kept saying no, as if he firmly believed this couldn't happen, and therefore it must not be happening. But I was unstoppable, and I did not stop. I left them lying together, their blood pooling into puddles, into deep enough puddles to drown in, into ponds, into lakes. And she told me not to watch it, that I had to keep going. I must not stop. I was unstoppable. Happy is the corpse that rain shines on. Owen Seabury, M.D. April 19, 1894. The Boston inspector didn't arrive yesterday morning as I was promised, but he came this morning instead, bright and early, if not so early as the sheriff had the day before. The sun was up. I'd had my coffee and toast, and I was as prepared as one could hope for what we were bound to find in the Hamilton home, where two people had died, and now nobody lived. The inspector's name was Simon Wolfe, a fine name for a man who hunts wrongdoers, but aside from his peculiarly practical nomenclature, he wasn't at all what I expected. Rather short, somewhat wide and thickly bespectacled, Wolf was nonetheless a sharp-witted man with an air of crisp professionalism about him. I knew immediately that I liked him, and that I could work with him. Together we approached Hamilton's Ocean Goods and Supplies, the store which the Hamiltons had kept and within which they'd lived, in the back rooms apart from the business front. The main entryway was closed off with rope, more for show than for restraint. A sign hung from the rope announcing that the shop was closed indefinitely, with the subsequent admonition, "Do not enter without police approval." But, as Wolf put it, "My approval is somewhat more official than mere police permission. So I'll see to the knot." "But you're a policeman, aren't you?" "Something like that." "I meant no offense, of course," I said, fearing I might have caused some all the same. He waved away my concerns. "None taken. Our officers work in close conjunction. Fine men, the Boston police. But no, I'm not one of them. Good heavens. It's a devil of a knot." I wasn't sure what he meant, but I did not inquire further. Instead, I said, "I have a penknife, if you think it'd help." Before I could finish the offer, he'd released the informal barrier with a determined pinch of manual dexterity. "Thank you, but I finally got it." He fished about in his pocket for a key given to him by the sheriff, I assumed. Or maybe it came courtesy of some other authority, as he implied. He found the key, retrieved it, and inserted it into the lock. "You've been here before? Is that correct?" "Everyone in town has been here at one time or another. It's a local institution, or it was, I'm sorry to say." The door unfastened, and he pushed it open. "There's always a chance that someone will reopen it, some family member or another, but the Hamiltons had no children." It wasn't a question. He was merely recalling the facts as he'd heard them. I wondered who'd filled him in on all the peripheral details. "A brother, or cousin, perhaps?" "Ebenezer had a brother, but he was a mariner, and I only met him once. He was older, too. For an old man who spent his life upon the sea, it might be a good retirement to operate a shop such as this." Or so I thought aloud. "Then again, perhaps he's lost his taste for living on solid ground. Some of them do, you know. They take to the ocean and never find comfort elsewhere." "I'll ask Mr. Hamilton when I speak to him next." "That poor man." He might have said more, but we both stepped inside, where the store was dark and strangely cool. Both of us went quiet. We milled about in the entryway beside the overflowing barrel of sea glass. It drew my eye even when I consciously decided that I must look elsewhere. Nervously, I said, "Bit of a chill in here. Bit of a smell, too. Did Dr. Hamilton mention it?" "Yes, he did. Compared it to the stomach contents of a beached whale. And he ought to know, for he helped discard one. It was the talk of the shores last summer." Wolf nodded. "The bowels of a rotting whale." "That sounds about right." He flinched, like he'd prefer to pinch his nose. "But it wouldn't be manly." "It is terrible," I agreed, though it wasn't quite the veritable wall of stench I'd been guaranteed. It was more of an undercurrent in the chilly, damp air, something riding the humidity as if the very mist itself was the source of the odor. It felt like some strange trespass to visit the store under these circumstances. Closed for business, perhaps for good. Dark and quiet, with no Felicity Hamilton behind the counter. No Matthew to refill the odds and ends barrel. No Ebenezer on the pier just outside, spreading out nets and sails to dry in the sun, later to be repaired. I wondered sadly what would become of the stock, of the store, of the building itself. "Can you imagine?" I murmured, scanning the room. "I can imagine many things," he replied. "But what precisely do you have in mind?" "Can you imagine buying a business or home like this, knowing what took place here? For generations, school children will accuse it of being haunted. You can rest assured of that.
Children and adults alike. It's not as if we ever outgrow our darker fears. Let's not pretend we're all so reluctant to entertain the unknown."
"Do you?" I asked bluntly.
He faced me, and even in the low light I could see how quizzically he regarded me. He was thinking about his answer. He didn't know me well, and wasn't sure of what might turn my opinion, or so I gathered. Entertain the unknown? I constantly do so. It comes with my job. I entertain it in order to solve it and make it known.
That isn't what I mean. I went to the big bay windows that overlooked the water and the pier, and I drew back the canvas curtains. Light flooded in, and the place looked dusty and abandoned despite the added illumination.
Are you asking if I believe in ghosts? Goblins? God?
There is no need to bring sacrilege to the conversation, I chided him.
Indeed. No reason to bring religion into it at all. Given my preference, I'd skip the subject altogether. Now tell me, where are the living quarters?
I accepted the shift in topic. It hadn't been polite for me to broach the other one anyway. In this direction, behind the curtain at the end of the counter. He brushed it aside and recoiled, examining his hand.
It's wet.
Everything feels wet in here, doesn't it? I ran my fingers over the slimy counter. I wiped my fingers on my pants, and Wolf wiped his on the hem of his jacket.
When did it rain last?
Oh, it's been a week or more. Last Tuesday, I believe. I can't imagine why it's so damp in here. But can't you feel it? Something abominable and atmospheric.
Something unknown?
He asked with the lift of an eyebrow. And I wasn't sure if he was teasing me or not, so I gave him a self-deprecating smile. If so, then it falls well within your job description.
Yours too,
he grinned back, revealing his picket-straight, shell-white teeth. I half expected to see canines every time he flashed them, but no, they were ordinary and I was an imaginative old fool. This much was established.
Mine too, yes, I agree.
Down the hall, I directed, suddenly feeling odd about our light-hearted exchange. This wasn't the place for it. Or maybe it was the best place for it, a feeble, mortal attempt to offset the terrible and unfathomable. Every moment, I turned Ebenezer's story over in the rear of my mind. Every moment it played in the background of my everyday thoughts, my everyday actions. The sound he described, the floating boy, the stench. That same stench rose as we slipped single file down the hall, toward Matthew's bedroom, much stronger than near the front of the store. Last door on the right, I said. I might not have bothered. He could have just followed the reek. The floorboards creaked beneath our shoes, and they were spongy when we stepped on them, like they'd been waterlogged. But they had been, hadn't they? If I believed Ebenezer at all, there'd been a great tide flowing from the walls themselves, draining into nowhere, lifting and drowning and killing. I told him that I did believe. At the time, I'd meant it. In retrospect, I wasn't so sure, but my heart went back and forth about it, seeking excuses and reasons, answers and logical explanations. I found none, and I saw plenty of evidence to support the veracity of every frightful word he'd whispered in that courthouse room. I followed Wolf down the dank hall, stinking of oceans and death. Here we were, and this was the smell, just as Ebenezer described it. And the whole building was wet and cool, and the ceiling felt improbably low, and I could feel my heart hammering around in my chest because too much of it was true. Too much already.
Dear God Almighty,
gagged Wolf. He surrendered and whipped a handkerchief out of his pocket and held it up over his nose.
It's infinitely worse back here.
If I'd had a handkerchief, I would have done the same. Matthew's room was a wreck of soaked bedding, warped floors, peeling wallpaper and moldering linens stained a bluish-greenish color. I reached inside for a switch. There must be gas throughout the building. I was reasonably confident, for I knew there were lights in the store itself. But the place was too sodden and the fixtures wouldn't spark. No comforting illumination came to warm us, and we were left with the dingy murk that showed us almost nothing.
One moment.
Wolf ducked past me, back into the store.
He returned with a long stick. A cane? A tool of some variety? I didn't notice. He used it to push back the lank, sticky curtains and give us something to see by, not that the daylight could show us much of note. With the morning sun streaming inside, we saw more clearly than at first, but there wasn't anything new to encourage us. We saw a room that looked like somehow it had been filled with a rancid tide. Oh, and there was blood, yes. A watered-down stain pooled along the bed and along the floor, matching Ebenezer's statement that Matthew had fallen half on the bed, half off it. And when I stepped back to the darkened hall, I realized there was more diluted blood on the floor. We'd walked right through it. Now that I knew it was there, I tiptoed around it as much as possible. And while Wolf made his inspection, I made mine. I knew from Ebenezer's testimony that the bloody stain left by Mrs. Hamilton was approximately 30 hours old. It was still half wet, like everything else. But unlike everything else, a gummy sputum was mixed with the froth that had surely spilled from her mouth. Quite a lot of it, really. It's a wonder we hadn't slipped and harmed ourselves. I peered around the door's jamb and saw Wolf cutting buckshot out of the far wall with a pocket knife, like a proper alienist. He dropped it into a glass vial and used a wad of cotton for a stopper. Then he pulled out a tape and measured the room. I offered to hold one end for accuracy. And when he was finished recording the dimensions, he retrieved a sketch pad from his inner jacket pocket. How he could stand to remain in that filthy, stinking room, I had no idea, but somehow the man had acclimated to breathing without his handkerchief. More power to him. I left him to sketch what he found important, and returned to the storefront area, which only felt grim and sad, rather than murderous and unsettling. I stood in the middle of the room, staring down the two aisles of products and back again at the counter and the register, and the faint tracks my fingers had left in the slime that coated everything. From a certain angle, I could even see our footprints on the floor when the light hit them just right. The whole place was tainted with something, and I was seized with the impulse to dash home and run myself a bath. But I could do that later. I kept my breathing shallow, lest I suck in any more of the disgusting air than I absolutely had to. And I strolled about, trying to be an observant and useful partner to Wolf, but mostly just wanting to take off my clothes and fling myself into the nearest supply of clean water. I wandered to the door, to the window beside it. The glass was murky like everything else, and when I ran the side of my thumb along the nearest edge of the pane, it came away black, almost as if it were the stain of old soot, or the residue of a place where men too often smoked. But that was a silly thought, wasn't it? Smoke and fire in a place all but destroyed with damp. It wasn't quite right, and I knew it. I can only talk my way around these things. There is so little that can be precisely said. The room was chilly, perhaps 60 degrees. I wished for a thermometer, but didn't have one handy and didn't see one in the store. The bloodstains were approximately 3 square feet and 4 square feet, respectively. Wolf's measuring tape would tell us more firmly. Edited to note, my guesses were good. I was only half a foot off in one case and a quarter foot in the other. I am at such a loss, without numbers to enter and symptoms to record, unless that's what I'm doing in this roundabout way, as I keep these journals and record the day's proceedings. I might be thinking about the situation too broadly. Wolf has his own notes, of course. I might ask to see them in order to better flesh out my own research. To return to my point, I stood by the door, by the window, and again I looked down into the barrel of odds and ends that Matthew so diligently filled until his last days. Same as before, it was overflowing with the excess deposited into buckets, jugs, and cups. No longer a barrel of goods. The goods had overtaken the space and now acquired other spaces nearby in which to collect and to spread. The goods had become a veritable colony. What a strange thing to write down. I'm not certain why I've done so, but there it is. That was what I thought, and how I felt. That's what I remember of it, and the rest is, frankly, foggy. But I need to stay on my toes and record it all to the best of my ability.
so I don't forget it later. I stood there by the barrel, by the colony of glittery glass bits and shimmering shells, and I felt distinctly like I was forgetting something, forgetting everything, slowly. Like as I lingered, my attention was being drained from my body, a very slow leak as from a balloon, and my awareness was sinking, dropping, falling. Oddly, I was not particularly worried by this. I was only interested in the glint of the light on the pretty rocks, and the clicking sound they made when I put my hand into the barrel, gently so I wouldn't cut myself on any sharp edges. Clicking together the pebbles and stones and glass, clicking like crab claws or beads on a necklace. Clicking like a necklace. But that doesn't make any sense, does it? Maybe not. Still, that was what sprang to mind, and something about the randomness of it all made me cling to it. It was too specific and weird to lack meaning. I might have mulled this over further, or then again I might have stood there all night, my fingers running through the barrel's contents, drawing little furrows, making tiny mounds and digging little holes. Except that Wolf joined me once again, having finished his examination of Matthew's bedroom. He said my name, loudly. He insisted that it was the third attempt to rouse my attention, and he asked if I was all right. But of course I was all right. Of course he didn't call my name thrice. I'm confident he must have been mistaken. No, that's not so. I'm not confident of anything. And the thoughtful look on his face suggested that I would dismiss his concern at my peril. Of course I'm all right, I said in response, shoving my hands into my pockets and clenching, unclenching my fists. My hands were cold from playing with the barrel's lifeless, brittle contents. I should hope so, because we've one stop left before I can return you to your routine, Doctor. I could have done this much of the trip myself, though I was happy for the company. No, sir, I need you for the funeral home. I want you to tell me about the bodies. Ah. It was all I could think to say. My hesitation likewise gave him pause. Ah? Is there some reason you'd prefer to bow out? No, no, that's not it, I said quickly. I'm sorry, I only had a moment of moral confliction. I reached for the door and opened it, letting the real world, the real ocean air, breathe into the store. Moral confliction? Of what sort? I'm terribly curious, that's all. I do indeed want to see them, I asserted, and this was true. But it would be unseemly to get too excited about it, don't you think?
Not at all.
Are you certain? He shut the door and locked it behind us.
We should always be excited about the pursuit of truth.
We stood there, taking in the sun, and together, I believe, we were both relieved at the normalcy of the morning on the shop's narrow stoop. With the door closed, there was no sign of what had gone on within. None but the warning sign, that is. It dangled from the rope, reminding me that I was wrong, and that I could pretend all I wanted that it was a beautiful day, and all was right with the world. But I was completely wrong. The funeral home was only a few blocks to the north, so we walked the distance together. I led the way at Wolf's request, but I got the distinct impression that he knew the general location already. He was obviously a man who came to every situation prepared. I wondered how prepared, and I frowned. But to parlay the act into something less vague, I returned to his last comment. You don't think it's strange at all? I asked him. You think it's well and good that we should grow giddy over the corpses of friends?
They're not my friends, he noted. And I said nothing about giddy, but I have no doubt that the deceased Hamiltons were fine upstanding citizens, so yes, I am all the more interested in their remains, that we might find the justice they so richly deserve.
But what justice is there when a malady is at fault? One can hardly prosecute an infection. I scoffed at the very idea. Matthew was ill, desperately so, and I can't speak as to the nature of his affliction. I did my best to treat him, but his condition was beyond my abilities.
Beyond anyone's but God's? Wolf asked.
He looked up at me with a tiny gleam in his eye. Beyond anyone's, I said carefully. Filthy atheist, he replied. It was meant to sound like a joke, so I laughed, but the laugh was awkward. My beliefs have no part in this case, and you were the one who wished to abandon the topic of religion, if I recall.